Charlie a Fellowship of the Sea welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for that introduction, Jim, and I want to thank Jay and the committee for inviting me to do something that that I've never done before, and that's speaking to a crowd like this. It's a little bit intimidating for me, but it seems, you know, about every time I give them a talk, I get a case of that inverted faith. It's a thing called fear, I guess that's not all bad. I've heard that it's not all bad, and I need to stay kind of green and fresh. I'm standing here today before you because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I see that grace up there behind me, and I took a pick at it when I came in, and I see it now because of God's grace and mercy, I'm alive and here today. And I owe an awful lot to this grace. Some of this grace I don't understand, you know. I've identified grace before, and I do today, as a grace as being something that identified as something that God has given me a wonderful gift of, and I've been granted abundant supply of it over the years, as you'll find out in just a few moments when you hear what I've got to say. I've tried to figure out, you know, where grace comes from and what it's all about, but I never have been able to. But several years ago, I was reading a book by an author named Dr. Scott Peck, and it's the book called The Road Less Traveled. And in this book, he identifies grace as a gift from God. And he tells about, you know, that it's a gift that, you know, we can't earn it. We can't buy it. We can't inherit it. It's just a gift. It just happens. And then he tells a story about the Yankee couple that was on their way to Florida from somewhere up north. I don't know, can't recall exactly where it was from. And they were going down south to Florida through the state of Georgia early one morning. They stopped in to have breakfast in a restaurant. And this guy orders a couple of scrambled eggs, bacon, toast, orange juice, and coffee. And a few minutes later, the waitress comes out with his breakfast, and there's a white substance on his plate. And he looks at the waitress, and he says, "What is that white glob on his plate?" And she immediately tells him, says, "Why, that is grits." And he says, "Well, I didn't order any grits." And she says, "I understand, but they just come with the deal. It just happens." And that's kind of the way he explains grace, and that's the way I kind of accept it today. It kind of happens, you know. You know, I can't earn it. I can't buy it. It just happens. And I go to church here, and I live here in Myrtle Beach, and I go to church just about every Sunday. And in this pew in front of me is a pew rack, and there's an old hymnal there, and I pick it up and turns to page 378 in this hymnal. And on that page is one of my favoritest old-time spiritual songs. It's called Amazing Grace. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. How amazing did that grace appear the hour I first believed. And that is one of the most special songs, and it just tells it all, because I was blind at one time because the alcohol had me blinded, and I just couldn't see because of this awful thing that was in my life. My sponsor told me early on, he says, "You know, you understand why you get sober?" And I said, "Well, I know you get sober because of a lot of problems." I said, he says, "Yeah, I understand that." But he says, "Well, we get sober," and he said, "one of the biggest reasons we get sober is because of never having any meaningful relationships, because I never had any meaningful relationships before I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, since I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do have meaningful relationships. And with it, there's no way in the world I could have ever achieved these meaningful relationships without a God of my understanding in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I today have a meaningful relationship with my wife, and I have a meaningful relationship with my children. I have a meaningful relationship with my mother-in-law, father-in-law, with people in the workplace, my partners. I have a meaningful relationship with people when I play golf, with people like Bud E., Bill J., You know, these people, they and oh, David, we have wonderful time today playing golf and fellowshipping in a social life today. I enjoy it like I never enjoyed it. I never thought it would be possible. I have a meaningful relationship with God today, which I never thought possible. I've been going to church all my life, but I understand when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and started learning a little bit about spirituality, I found out, you know, that what I really was just a churchy, and all I did was go to church on Sunday, go out and do what a lot of these other fools do the rest of the week that didn't go to church. But it wasn't very meaningful to me. But this is the meaningful relationship I had today. I have a very meaningful relationship even with myself today, something I've never had in my life. Thank God for that. And, you know, when I was growing up, life was tough, very difficult. And life is tough today. But I learned that, you know, if I accept that to be fact, you know, it will become a little bit easier. I was born in this county. A lot of people don't know exactly where Loris is. So if you go to North Myrtle Beach and you go due west 20 miles, that's the town of Loris. Well, between Loris and Tabor City is where I was born. Tabor City is right below the Mason-Dixon line, if some of you don't remember where that is. But we were born on a farm. I was the seventh boy and 11th child of 12 children. We were turnip farmers, sharecroppers, some of you may call them. But we had an old house that we lived in, and it was we had no indoor plumbing and electricity until I was about almost 13 years of age. And the old house had some cracks in the eastern side of the house, and when the sun would come up in the mornings, you could see the sun just beaming through those cracks in the walls, and the old house was built about 3 or 4 feet off the ground, and it had cracks in it too. And in the wintertime, when it get real cold, yeah, we piled a bunch of these quilts that my mother had made on these beds, and in fact, we had so many on that you could barely turn over. And if you had an accident, it got tough. And if you had an accident between two brothers, it got even tougher. And my dad, he was a decent man. He had a second grade education. He had a problem with alcohol that I was told some time ago that he had a problem with it. I never did see him. My dad drank much because he was in his early 40s when I was born, and they say he had a problem, but that's about the time he quit. And he was a good, decent man, but he was a very insecure person, and he was a hard worker. He believed in hard work. He made all of his children work from daylight until the sun went down every day of the week except Sunday. Sometimes on Saturday, it'll let you off about 12 o'clock and take you into town that afternoon for 2 or 3 hours. But I always often thought about, since I got sober, that he was probably a good, maybe a black belt member of Al-Anon. And the reason I say that is because my dad never enabled any of his children, especially me. But I got in a lot of trouble growing up, and I got in a lot of trouble after I become a grown man too. But he never once bailed me out of one bit of trouble, never enabled me one time that I can recall. My mother was a very spiritual person. I learned a lot from my mom. She was one of the dearest people I've ever known, and she was a very spiritual person. She was the backbone of our family. And this lady loved to pray, and she loved people. And she would pray for her children. She would pray for her entire family. She prayed for sick people. She prayed for poor people. She prayed for anybody that was in need. And I remember her praying just about all the days that I was home. 18 years I was in that home that I can remember. She hit her knees every night and prayed, and always admired her for that. There never was a choice as to whether we went to church or not. Every Sunday morning, we went to church. It made no difference whether the old truck was running or not. We walked. It didn't make any difference. We went to church. We went to Sunday school. We went to a Baptist church. We went to 10 o'clock Sunday school, 11 o'clock preaching, and if you were lucky, you got out at about 1:30 in the daytime. The church was our social life, our spiritual life, our recreational life. We were back there on Sunday night for Baptist Training Union, on Wednesday night for prayer meeting. And a couple of times a year, we'd have revivals. And it was at one of these revivals that my mother, just about everyone we ever had that I can remember, she'd always grab one of her children to go to the altar. The preacher this night, he had an altar call. And my mother was sitting up in the front part of the church over in this section, and up the aisle on this section back here is where most of us children always sat. And she would come back and get one of us every time we had a revival to go up there and give our heart and soul to God. So this particular night, I was 12 years of age. She came up that aisle, and I just knew she was coming to get me. And she got over, and I said, "Lord, please don't let her come get me." And she got over, and she grabbed me by the ear. She said, "Son, get up and come here." I did exactly what she told me to do. She said, "You get up there and go to that altar, and you get down on your knees, and you give your heart and your soul to God." And I, being the good boy that I was, I said, "Yes, ma'am." So I went up there and got down on my knees at that altar, and I did everything in my power to give my heart and soul to God. I prayed as fervently as I knew how to pray to do that. And then after that service that night, I went home. And this old house that we live in, it had a porch on three sides of the house. And we had a big pile of tobacco prepared to go to market the following day. And I crawled up on that pile of tobacco, and I started gazing out into space and looking up at the stars and the moon, and I started thinking. I said, "Lord, you know, I just got through giving my heart and soul to you, and I do not feel any different." And I didn't. And you know, I didn't know exactly what it was all about until 28 years later that I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and started working the third step, and I understood exactly what she was talking about. I went to school there in the lower school system, grades 1 through 12. And when I was a little fella, from the time I was a little fella, and I used to watch my brother, one of my older brothers, play football. I loved football. And finally, in the eighth grade, I started playing. And the only reason I could play was because we didn't have to work in the tobacco fields, corn fields, and things like that in the fall of the year. And so I started playing football in the eighth grade. And football became an integral part of my life for 14 years. But my dad never saw me play a football game. And I always regretted that. When I was a senior in high school, I was a decent football player, and I was offered football scholarships at various colleges, and I chose the University of Tulsa out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I go out to Tulsa and had a good year there, but I was homesick, and I kind of wanted to go to school and play football in the state that I was planning to live in anyway, so I transferred back to Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina, and played football there 4 years. And upon graduation, I came to Myrtle Beach. And I got into coaching and teaching profession. And southwest of here, about 7 miles, is Socastee High School. And Socastee didn't have a football program at the time, and we combined it with Myrtle Beach High School. The South Carolina High School League allowed this to happen. So I was assistant football coach over at Myrtle Beach High School, and then I went out to Socastee, and I was the head basketball coach, athletic director, track coach, golf coach, and a janitor. And I did that for 2 years. And then three big things happened in my life. One, I got married. Two, I joined a church for the first time in my life. And three, I became the head football coach and athletic director at Myrtle Beach High School. I did that for 2 years. And then I wasn't certified to teaching. It was real tough for me. I loved the coaching, but the teaching was pretty tough for me. My major was in economics and business administration, and I just didn't have the courses and things it took to teach. And so I got out of the coaching and teaching profession, went into food business. I had assisted my brother part-time in the food business for about 6 or 7 years prior to this. And so I went into food business, and I did that for 2 years. And then in 1969, in the winter of 1969 and 70, a friend of mine leased an oceanfront lot, and we built a motel, and that's the business I'm in today by the grace of God. I had my first encounter with alcohol when I was 12 years of age. My dad kept an old half a gallon of white whiskey in the cabinet in our kitchen. And they said that this whiskey was there for medical reasons. And at that time, my mother made a concoction called camphor. And I know some of you may know what I'm talking about. But we didn't have any aspirins in our home at that time. We didn't have very little of any kind of medication. But this was used for bruises, headaches, anything in the world. Just you'd rub your head if you had a headache with it. If you had a sore muscle, you'd rub your muscle with whatever it was. But anyway, one day I got the bright idea, and I don't know why, unless I was looking for recognition. But I decided to take some of that whiskey to school with me. So I got me old ball fruit jar, pint jar, and I filled it about half full. And I took it to school with me. And at recess, which is one of my favorite times of the day, I went out on the school grounds. I took that whiskey with me. And I had my two little buddies, and I got them off to the side and showed them this whiskey. And they dared me to take a drink. And I told them that I would if they would. I did, and they didn't. And I poured the balance of the whiskey on one of the little guys. And he goes inside and tells my seventh grade teacher. She's the prettiest little lady I've ever seen in my life. And I love that teacher. I sat up on that front row and always kept my shirts ironed and looking good, my hair in place, and because I wanted to impress that lady. And that boy went in there and told her that day that I poured that whiskey on him, and it just broke my heart. And that ain't all that got broke. She took me home that afternoon, and my dad whipped my tail. When I was 13 years of age, this was in the fall of the year, too, and I was working in the largest grocery store over there in Lawrence, and I was working there as a bag boy. And at lunchtime, I go to the pool room for lunch. I had 50 cents in my pocket, two quarters. And I see these guys over there shooting pool, and they were standing around drinking beer. And I thought that was kind of neat, and so I ordered me, had a special on hot dogs, two for a quarter. So I got me two hot dogs and a beer, and I sat down and I ate those hot dogs and drank that beer, and I really enjoyed it. And I got up and went back to work, and I don't know, folks, but looking back today, this is the first sign of my alcoholism, because when I got back to work, I wanted to go reach that next level, but an interesting thing happened. I didn't have any money. At that time, in that grocery store, the meat department, everybody bought groceries in there. They paid for all their groceries except the meats at the front door through the cash register. If you bought your meat, you paid for it back in the meat department. And my good friend, old Lawrence Willis, who's dead today, Lawrence Willis, was one huge, big butcher. He was a big guy. And he collected all the money for all the meats that were sold in that grocery store. And back behind the meat counter was a butcher block. And on this butcher block was a cigar box. And in that cigar box is where he put the money that he collected for those meats. Well, I got back there kind of close to old Lawrence. He was kind of big, and he'd turn around to wait on somebody. And I'd slip my hand in that cigar box, and I'd get a quarter out. And I went back over there two more times that day trying to get to that next level. Trying to get to that next level. Stealing and drinking, trying to get to that next level. When I was 14 years of age, I had my first blackout. When I was 16, it was the worst year of all my teen years. 16 was the worst. I had encounters with the police four different times, and everything was because of alcohol. I've heard it said many times, you know, that alcohol, you know, just about everything bad that ever happened to me was when I was under the influence of alcohol. And that was true of me. But looking back, I never thought about it when I was growing up and when I was drinking all through the years, those 28 years of drinking. I never realized, you know, that was the cause of or start of my problems. But I had, I was drunk and disorderly, drunk in destruction of property, drunk in destruction of private property. Everything was always directly because I was drinking alcohol. And my dad never bailed me out, not one time. My senior year in high school, I slowed down a little, trying to prepare myself for the rest of my life. So I drank mainly on weekends. And during the summer after I graduated, I drank about every night. During my college days and during my coaching career, I drank mostly on weekends. But after I got out of the coaching profession and went into the private business sector, my wife and I drank sometimes 5, 6, 7 nights a week. But it was none less than 5 nights a week. And then we started having problems. And then she and I started compromising our moral values and our spiritual values. Then we started having verbal altercations. And then we had physical altercations. And then it ended up in divorce. A painful divorce, the most emotional, painful thing that I've ever been through. But I know today that I could probably have never gotten sober if I hadn't gotten divorced. For the next 5 years, my drinking got progressively worse. And I've heard it said, you know, that the disease of alcoholism is chronic and it's progressive. And I believe that as much as I'm standing here today, because it never did get any better. It did get worse. And for the next 5 years, I wallowed in my mess, and I felt so sorry for myself, and the only relief that I could find was alcohol. So I drank to just kill the pain that I was going through, and did a pretty good job of it. And I had a few of my friends started talking to me and telling me, said, look here, you need to do something about your drinking. It's getting a little out of hand. And I said, I will. I think I can do that. And for 90 days, I quit just to prove to myself and prove to them that I didn't have to have alcohol. And then, but that was probably the most miserable 90 days that I've ever had in my life. Then after I started back, it got progressively worse. And as old Jimmy Smith said, he's not here with us anymore, but he said it got worser and worser. And believe me, it did get worse and worse. I had all kinds of problems that happened. And automobile accidents, boating accidents, and DUIs. I had it all. It made no difference what I drank, when I drank, where I drank, or who I drank with. Bad things invariably seemed to happen. They happened, and it just kept getting worse. And got to a point where I'd wake up in the mornings and I was in a lot of pain. And I can relate to what Bill Wilson says, you know, in his story. He says he'd wake up in the morning and feel so bad, he'd swear up and down he'd never take another drink. And before the sun went down that day, he'd be drunk again. That was exactly what I did, because I felt the same way and had that happen. I started waking up with the shakes so bad, the DTs so bad. And then the only thing I could find for relief was drinking. I tried not to take a drink until after 5 o'clock. But the pain got so great that I couldn't. I tried to do a payroll on Fridays, and I shook so bad I couldn't sign my name to a check. And I'd go to get me 3 or 4 beers or a bottle of wine, then I could go sign it, just no problem whatsoever. My partners and I used to go to lunch, and I'd be shaking so bad. And I love vegetable lunches. And we'd sit there and have lunch, and I could barely get a fork to my mouth. And folks, do yourself a favor. If you ever have anything like that happen to you, don't order garden peas. That's a tough thing to get to your mouth. I promise you it is. I've been in banks to sign notes and have to leave the bank to go drink whiskey, beer, or wine to go back and where I could sign my name. I've been in real estate closings where I couldn't sign my name. I'd have to go back and get me a few drinks of something, some alcohol of some kind, before I could ever sign my name. My last week of drinking, my partner and I went on a business trip to Daytona Beach. On the way to Daytona Beach, he took care of the driving, I took care of the drinking. We got to Daytona Beach, he took care of the business, I took care of the drinking. On the way back from Daytona Beach, he took care of the driving, I took care of the drinking. Right on the outside of the city limits of Myrtle Beach, he looked at me and he said, Charlie, he said, man, you need to do something about your drinking. And I looked at him and I said, for the first time in my life, I said, you know what? I said, I agree with you. I said, I know I need to do something about my drinking, but I don't know exactly what to do. He said, if I bring somebody to your apartment tomorrow morning, he said, would you be willing to listen to him? And I said, I'll be happy to. He said, I'll have him there at 10 o'clock the following morning. He dropped me off at my apartment, and it was July the 30th, and it was hot. I mean, it was real hot, and I had to negotiate two sets of stairs going up to my apartment on the third floor, and it took me a long time to get up there. And the next day was my birthday, and I had been in Florida, and my driver's license had expired, but I wasn't worried about no driver's license. But I finally got to my apartment. The next morning, I woke up and felt pretty rough. And I knew these guys were coming, and I knew I had to get the feeling halfway decent. So I went to the refrigerator, got me a bottle of wine, and took me drank three or four glasses of that wine. Feeling pretty good, and those guys came in at 10 o'clock, and the guy that he brought into my apartment was a doctor. And he is a friend of mine, a friend that I had drunk a lot of whiskey with and partied a lot with. But he sat in, he told me about his life. He told me that he had gone to a treatment center, and he'd been sober for 14 months. And he told me that he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we talked for about an hour. When he got through talking, I asked him, I said, what do you suggest I do? He said, I suggest you go to a treatment center. And I said, okay. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, from this point, I was a heavy smoker. I smoked 2.5-3 packs of cigarettes a day and drank a lot of alcohol. I said, from this point on, I said, I'm not going to smoke another cigarette. I'm not going to take another drink of liquor. I'll come to your office Monday morning, get me a physical. I'm going to go get my driver's license renewed. It had expired that day before. And I'll come to your office, get a complete physical, get my driver's license renewed, and then I'll go to that treatment center on Tuesday morning. And he looked at me and he said, well, he said, number one, ain't no sense in you coming to my office to get a physical Monday morning. He says, you'll probably get the most complete physical where you're going that you've ever had. He said, tell me too, he said, it really ain't no sense you quitting drinking. He said, they'll help you quit drinking where you going. And I bade them farewell, and they walked out the door. And when the door closed, I said, did he say not to quit drinking? So I went bouncing down those two sets of stairs, and I got in my car, and I went to the nearest liquor store, and I got me a quart of vodka, a quart of Kahlua, stopped at the grocery store and got me a gallon of milk. And I went home and I started making those milkshakes. Now, folks, I do not remember taking my last drink. I blacked out and I passed out. The next morning I woke up. I felt pretty good. Went through the kitchen there and looked. And that bottle of vodka was empty. There's about that much Kahlua left in the other bottle. I said, boy, I did that justice. Just to ensure that I continued feeling pretty good, I went to my medicine cabinet, and I got me two aspirins. I got a couple of Alka-Seltzers and a shot of Pepto-Bismol. I went bouncing down those stairs, got my Sunday morning paper, and came back upstairs, and I sat down in my rocking chair, and I started reading the paper, and then a few moments later, I got nauseated, and a few minutes later, I got sick, and I started puking. Now, my wife hates that word. She just can't stand it, but I'm going to have to tell you the truth. That's the sickest I've ever been in my life. I went to the grocery store and got me a few jars of Gatorade. It seemed like every time I drank a jar of Gatorade, I'd throw up too. And it was tough. It was tough for the rest of that day into the night. And late that night, I finally eased off and sat up in the bed. But I was scared to death to go to sleep because I didn't think I'd ever wake up. And I'd asked God to help me out of this problem so many times in the past, and I just felt pure guilty to ask him about helping me anymore in the future about that. And so I laid there for the rest of that night just with my eyes wide open, just shaking like a leaf on a tree. The next morning I got up, and I went to get my driver's license. I was shaking so bad. This highway patrolman looked at me, and I'd had a fella to call him and get him to renew my license. He said, all you got to do is sign right here. And I said, I can't do it. He said, I can't do it. He said, just scratch something. It looked like a chicken scratching. That's where Simon Eden. I took care of a little bit of business, and the next morning I went to that treatment center. They want you to sign a paper when you come in and give them a deposit, and I couldn't do either one of them. It was 10 days before I settled down enough where I could, where my mind, where I could think, and my insides quit shaking. And for the first time in my life, I started taken a look at myself. And they say, you know, before, they say a man before the age of 40 has a tendency to look outside at all the material things, the financial things. After the age of 40, I have a tendency to look inside, because that's usually just the beginning of the second half of your life. And so I started looking in here. These defects of character, the things that, you know, have been really causing me problems all these years. At this treatment center, this guy got appointed to be my counselor. And he was a wonderful person. A lot of people, you know who he was. His name was Willie Fabian. He's dead now. He's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just always be eternally grateful for Willie sharing with me. But what he started me out was telling me about the disease that I had. He said, alcoholism is a disease. He said, it's the disease that you are not responsible having, but it's a disease that you're responsible for treating. And he says, you need to surrender. You need a total surrender. Surrender to win. Surrender to live. And you know, I'd heard about surrender all my life, because see, I've been to see some of those John Wayne movies. And he'd get those bad guys backed up in the corner, and invariably, they'd come out there with that white flag. Because those guys didn't want to die. They were surrendering, and that's exactly what he was asking me to do and telling me that I needed to do with my life. He said, you not only need a recovery, but you need a spiritual recovery. And I believe that. I believe that I need a spiritual recovery today. And so I rocked along there and, you know, started taking inventory of me and, you know, the way I felt and thought and the things I'd done in the past and stuff. And after I'd been there about 3 weeks, I went to see Willie and told Willie, I said, Willie, ain't it about time for me to get out of here? And because I finally woke up and realized it cost me $500 a day to stay there. And he, you know, my insurance didn't pay for 3 days of detoxification. But folks, I'm going to tell you, that money that I spent for that treatment center took me 2 years to pay those folks back. But I don't regret ever paying them a penny, because that's how much it meant to me, learning about this disease and trying to do something about it. So I went to see Willie, asked him, wasn't about time for me to get out of there. And he said, nope, you're not ready. I went back two more times, said, nope, you're not ready. So on the 26th day, which is a Friday, I went in there and I said, Willie, I want to buy one of those 12 and 12 books, and I want one of those big blue books. And he said, you're ready to go. And I said, my gosh, if I'd have known that, I'd have left a week earlier. I'd have been there buying that book. So we talked for a few minutes, and they had an aftercare program there. And just like I said, it's on Friday. He says, every Wednesday night for the next 6 weeks, I want you to come back here for an aftercare meeting. And I told him I would. And he says, I want you to remember two other things. He said, you came to this treatment center to get sober. So when you leave here and go back to Myrtle Beach, says, you go back to Myrtle Beach, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober. And I thanked him, and we hugged each other, and I left there. I came back to Myrtle Beach, had a wonderful ride from Charleston back to the beach, and the first place I was going was my office. And right up the street here on Highway 17 is 16th Avenue, there's a signal light there. And I pulled up and the light was red. And there's a car in front of me. And on the right-hand bumper, there's a bumper sticker there. It says, honk if you love Jesus. And I was feeling good. And I laid down on that horn just as hard as I knew how to lay down. And all of a sudden, this fella jumps out of that car, is driving that car. He looked at me and he said, man, he said, what in the living hell's wrong with you? Can't you see the light's red? And I said, welcome to sobriety. But you know, I didn't react in a negative way. I didn't react in a negative way at all. The following Monday night, I went to my first AA meeting. And folks, I drove around. It's downtown Myrtle Beach. My sponsor, the guy that sent me to this treatment center, he had told me where to go to a meeting. So I went downtown Myrtle Beach, and right above the pool room in the judge's office is the place where we had our meetings. And this was a rough place up there. I mean, it's pretty rough. There's people in this room that's been there a few times. And And I drove around and around the block trying to find a place. There's a bunch of lights out there. And I ran around trying to find a place to park. So nobody wouldn't see my car and recognize me going in this place. And so on Wednesday night, I go back for my aftercare program. And old Willie asked me, he said, Charlie, how things going? How did things go at your meeting? And I said, well, everything went fine, except for one thing. I said, I couldn't find a place to park where people wouldn't recognize me going in that meeting. He said, what? I said, yeah. He said, my God, Charlie. And y'all can remember how tough he talked. He said, my God, Charlie. He said, you go up here to the Carolina Cup in Camden, that race up there, that horse race. He said, you get drunk and show yourself all over the place. He said, you go to Myrtle Beach, get out there on the Strand. He said, you get drunk, start showing yourself and get put in jail. He said, you go to the Carolina Clemson football game and get drunk, fall down the steps. And he said, all of a sudden, you're ashamed for somebody to see you sober. And there's so much truth in that. The first AA meeting I was at, there was this lady there that said she stayed sober the first year of her life with an attitude of gratitude. And I thought that was the most unique comment statement that I'd ever heard. And I went home that night and I thought about all the things I had to be grateful for. My mother, my dad, all the physical things, material things, monetary things. And the next AA meeting I go to, the topic of the meeting that night was on gratitude. And the very first thing somebody said, well, you know, said gratitude is not a passive word. Gratitude is action. Go to meetings. Chair meetings, make coffee. At that time, clean ashtrays and clean up the place and get involved in service work and stuff like that. That's what gratitude is all about. The next meeting I go to is on sponsorship. And they told me how important it was to get a sponsor. And, you know, to find somebody that you could identify with, somebody you admired and respected their sobriety, the way they lived, what, you know, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I chose the guy that sent me to that treatment center and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he told me, he said, Charlie, says, I want to tell you something. He says, I'm honored that you asked me to do that. He says, but, you know, he says, I believe you can help me just as much as I can help you. He says, I'm not going to put myself up here and I'm not going to put you down here. He says, we'll get in here together. He said, together, he said, we can work these steps and go to meetings and we can do whatever it takes to stay sober. And he said, here's my phone numbers. You can call me any time of the day or night. And he said, let's communicate. He says, when we start these steps, he said, we talk about it. And we did. And he pointed me in a direction. And he pointed me in a direction, and I never looked back. And the reason I didn't look back is because, folks, I felt so much pain during the time of those 28 years. Some was better and some was worse. But I felt a lot of pain during those years. And it was emotional pain. I had financial pain too, physical pain, emotional pain, all types of pain. But then he and I'd get to talking, and he'd say, you know, I'd get to talking about this pain, and he'd say, CF, he said, always do yourself a favor. He says, anytime you have that pain, he said, welcome it. Welcome that pain to test your strength, and then you can grow, and then you can know peace and joy and happiness. And I heard that so many times I thought I'd throw up. But he always talked about that. And then he said, you know, that pain is necessary. You know, misery is optional, like you've been having in your life. But he said, that pain is necessary. It'll motivate you to do something about it. And he said, always remember one thing. He says, all you're responsible for is the effort. He says, get in these steps and work them and live them and practice them in all areas of your life. He said, but work them to the best of your ability. All you're responsible for in any area of your life is the effort, not the result. Put the effort there, your best effort, and then leave the results to God. And I thought that was just a profound statement, and I've tried to implement that into my life. Nobody likes to admit defeat, but alcohol defeated me. It caused me a lot of pain. It defeated me. But I know today, you know, admission of my powerlessness and possessing humility is very important to my sobriety. And I know today that God will rightly, if I rightly relate myself to Him, that He'll restore me to sanity. Because, you know, possession of humility, having that humility and having an open mind will help me a lot with my faith. And I need that. And that third step, I understood exactly what my mother was talking about when I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And in this step, you know, practicing this step is just like opening that door back there, you know, when it's closed and locked. All I need is a key and a decision, and that door will open. But the thing I got to do is have a thing called willingness. If I ain't got the willingness, it won't happen. Two of the most important words I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous is willingness and honesty. When I got into step four, I broke that down into three parts and did it just like the big book talked about. Resentment, it says, is our number one offender. When I got to dealing with fear, I tried to learn to trust God rather than trusting myself. When it got into the sex problems, it tells me that book, and I need to take a look at me to see where I've been selfish, to see where I've been dishonest, and see where I've been inconsiderate. When I got in step five, I had no problem at all admitting to God and to myself the exact nature of my wrongs, but I swore that I'd go to my grave before I'd ever disclose some of the things that I'd done in my life. Then I read a little bit further in step five, and it says, you know, if you don't work this vital step like you should, you may not have had your last drink. So I got pretty serious about working that step, and I went to my sponsor and the things that I was withholding from another human being, I shared it all. I took a couple hours and shared it with my sponsor. And when I got through, the tears were running from my eyes, very emotional, but the most spiritual, best feeling I've ever had in my life. I've never had a feeling in my life. I saw this lady right here sitting in front of me at a meeting last night, and she got to talking about that spirituality. And I went home last night and told my wife, I said, she reminded me and my mama about the way we feel about our spirituality. And I tell you, it is wonderful. It is wonderful. I can't get enough of it. And that lady last night didn't seem she could get enough of it either. And it just touched my heart, what just reminded me so much of what I've been through. Remind me of this baby skunk and a mama skunk was walking down the road one day, and they were passing this paper mill, and there's this awful stench being extracted from this paper mill, and that baby skunk looked over at mama and said, "Phew wee," said, "What in the world is that I smell?" And that mama skunk reared back and said, "says I don't know, son. Said daggone, we ain't got to get us some of that." And that's exactly the same way I feel about that spirituality. I tell you, that stuff, it do get good. In step six and seven, I you know, was willing to have God remove all my defects of character. The one thing that I believe that I need to do, and I try to do on a daily basis, is to make sure that there's nothing there that interferes with me and my relationship with God. When I started doing those amends, I had a spiritual experience after I did every one of them. Every time I did one, I had a spiritual experience. The maintenance step today, can't speak of anything any more important to me, because see, in step 10, it tells me I got a daily reprieve. And you heard Bob a while ago when he was reading, I got a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. If I got my spiritual condition in good shape, everything else is okay, no matter what. And so today, I still need to take a look at me on a daily basis to see where I've been self-centered, dishonest, inconsiderate, continually watching for those fears and resentments. I need to watch those. In step 11, I do every day of my life on my knees. I ask for the knowledge of God's will for me every morning of my life and the power to carry it out every morning. Real important. I pray a lot. I pray the third step prayer, the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer. I pray for people in Alcoholics Anonymous, people that I sponsor, people that I don't sponsor, people that sponsor me. I just can't. I talk to my sponsor. I got a couple of people that are very meaningful today in my life that are very meaningful, and we communicate on a continuous basis. But I believe in that power of prayer. And I get on my knees to do it because I think that's an act of humility. And in that 12th step, I can't say enough about it. I mean, just like a Willie Fabian told me, every time I ever heard him talk at a meeting, he always ended his talk But what he had said in AA meeting was about he can do all things if he takes those steps and go out and practice them in all his affairs. And I believe that. And it tells us in the big book in step 12 that the greatest insurance we have of taking another drink is to work with another alcoholic. And I believe that. I heard a motivational speaker talking one time. He was standing up at that podium and he got a little bit excited. He was pounding on that podium. He said, "You got to pay the price for success. You got to pay the price for success." I submit to you, you don't pay a price for success. And that's exactly what alcoholics is all about. You see, I paid a lot of prices when I was out there drinking. You know, all the pain and the suffering I went through, I paid a big, big price for all those things. But since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been achieving the awards and the rewards. And I tell you, it has been just wonderful to do that. And I just love it. And the way that I try to grow is every day you grow spiritually. And I'm reminded about this this man had his little son sitting in his lap one night reading him the Bible story about David and Goliath. And I know a lot of you probably heard about that. But anyway, this little shepherd boy was about 15 years of age. And he took him a slingshot with a little pebble in it. And he went up and faced this 8-foot giant called Goliath. And Goliath was a bad dude. And there's just no way that a little small shepherd boy could kill a giant like that. Except for one thing. It was God inspired. Him and God could do anything. He took that pebble and that slingshot and he killed that giant. And that little old boy looked up at his daddy. He said, "Daddy, you know, since I feel kind of sorry for old Goliath." And his daddy looked back and he said, "Oh, why you say that, son?" He said, "Well," he said, "you see, old David had God on his side." He said, "Goliath didn't have nobody on his side." You see, alcohol was the Goliath in my life. It caused me a lot of problems. But me and God got a hold of it. Because of the inspiration of God, God's help and guidance and direction, him doing the steering, me taking the action, is what it's all about. There in that 12th step, it tells us that the joy of living is the theme to that step. Action is what it's all about. If we put the action there, the joy will come. A few years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., in front of the Washington Monument. And there's a long line there, and the tradition at the time was to take the elevator to the top. Get on the elevator, go to the top, and walk the steps back down. There was two long lines, about 100 yards each, out in front of these elevators. And all of a sudden, I looked over to the right of the elevators, and there was a door. And right above that door, there was these words up. It said, "There is no waiting to get to the top if you're willing to take the steps." Well, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really believe from the bottom of my heart that you can get just as high as you want to get. If we take these steps, if I work them, if I live them, if I practice them in all my affairs, I believe that can happen. You see, today I have a wonderful relationship with God, and I want this every day. And we're going to go. And this is what I do in my life every day. I try to grow and grow and grow spiritually. And hopefully I end up one with God. And that's what my ultimate goal is. That's what my mission is to end up there with God. And so that's why I try to live and work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in all areas of my life. Three things that I hear read at just about every meeting I go to that are very important to me. One is I'm an alcoholic. And I have no control over anything. No other human being can relieve me of my alcoholism. But I know that God could and he will if I seek him. The secret to this whole thing is in seeking. May God bless each one of you. Thank you.